Hartman, The Anarchist, or The Doom of the Great City, by E. Douglas Fawcett, illustrated by Fred T. Jane, published 1893. Chapter 5, A Strange Awakening. Where was I? I seemed to be escaping from the throes of some horrible dream, and that, too, with a headache past endurance. I stretched out my right hand, and it struck something cold and hard. I opened one eye with an effort, and I saw three men bending over me as one sees specters in a nightmare. Slowly there was borne upon me the sound of voices, and then the cruel remembrance of that struggle. I was in a police cell, and might have to expiate my misfortunes with shame or even death. Who was to believe my tale? Horrified at the thought, I gave utterance to a deep groan.
"There's not much up with your pal, Jack," said one of the specters aforesaid. "Give him some more whiskey. He's hit his head and got knocked silly, that's all."
What was this? A surge of blood coursed through me. I made the supreme effort and opened both eyes fully. The light was poor, but it was enough. The face of the man nearest me was the face of Burnett. By him stood a rough-looking artisan, and by all that is marvelous, Michael Schwartz.
"Here, take this," said Burnett. A rough-looking man handing him a glass.
"You'll be right in a minute." I drank it off mechanically and, imbued with new strength, sat bolt upright on the bench. Burnett watched me satirically as I tried to cope with the situation. By the light of a small lamp hanging over the niche over my head, I saw that I was in a low, small room, about 12 feet square, with bare grayish-looking walls and a few stilt-like openings near the ceiling, which did duty, no doubt, for windows. A few chests, several chairs, and a table of the same grayish color constituted its furniture. Almost directly opposite me was a low door through which blew gusts of chilly mist, and to what lay beyond it I could not, of course, form a conjecture. Having made this rapid survey, I turned in astonishment to my three stolid companions, mutely entreating some sort of clue to the mystery. Schwartz then made an attempt to rouse me by asking how I had enjoyed my nocturnal run in the park. But I was still too surprised to answer. I was thinking how Burnett could have carried me safe away, where he could possibly have brought me, what had become of our pursuers, where were the mysterious Hartman was, and who had fired the shots. These and a multitude of like riddles rendered me speechless with bewilderment. When I had more or less fully regained voice and strength, I turned to Burnett, and ignoring the impish Schwartz, said curtly, "Where on earth am I?"
"You aren't on earth at all," was the answer, and all three burst into a hearty laugh. "Nor in heaven," added the speaker, "for so neither Schwartz nor Thomas could be near you."
"Come, a truce to humbug. Am I in London? On the river in an anarchist haunt, or where?"
"I'm quite serious, but if you want something more explicit, well, you're not in London, but above it."
I looked at the three wonderingly. A faint light was beginning to break on my mind, but no, the thing was impossible.
"Are you to walk away now?" said Burnett. "Come, Schwartz. You take one arm and I'll take another. Between us we'll give Mr. Constitutionalist a lesson. Stanley, my boy, in all your days you never saw a sight such as I'm going to show you now."
"But it is nothing to what we shall see, comrade, when the captain gives the word," added Schwartz.
"Thank you," I replied. "I will lean on you, Burnett. I can do without Herr Schwartz's assistance." We moved across the room.
"Hist!" whispered Burnett. "Don't be nasty to the German. He's the captain's right hand. It was he, too, who knocked over your man just now and so saved you from trouble. Take my advice and be discreet."
I nodded. "But who?" "Wait a moment and look around you."
We crossed the doorway and were standing in a sort of open bulwarked passage which evidently ran on for some length on either side. I stepped to the bulwarks.
"Look below," said Burnett. I looked long and earnestly while Schwartz and Thomas stood silently in the background. It was a strange sight, and it was some time ere I seized its meaning. It was very dark outside, the only light being that coming through the doorway of the chamber I had just quitted, but far below, as it seemed, glittered innumerable specks like stars, a curious contrast to the inkiness of the cloudy pall above us. As I gazed down into the depths, I became conscious of a dull murmur like that of whirling machinery, and forthwith detected a constant vibration of the ledge on which my elbow rested. Then, and only then, the truth rushed upon me. I was being carried over London in the craft of Hartman, the anarchist. Horrified with my thoughts, for the potentialities of this vessel dazed me, I clung fiercely to Burnett's arm.
"I am then on the,"
I guessed.
"Deck of the Attila," put in Burnett. "Behold the craft that shall wreck civilization and hurl tyrannies into nothingness."
But my gaze was fixed on those lights far below, and my thought was not of the tyrannies I had left, but of the tyranny this accursed deck might minister to. And Hartman, they said, was remorseless.
"Yes," growled Thomas hoarsely, "I live for the roar of dynamite."
Schwartz stirred to enthusiasm and shouted a brutal parody of Tennyson.
The dynamite falls on castle walls, and splendid buildings old in story. The column shakes, the tyrant quakes, and the wild wreckage leaps in glory. Throw, comrade, throw, set the wild echoes flying. Throw, comrade, throw, answer wretches, dying, dying, dying.
If the remainder of the crew resembled this sample, I was caged in a veritable inferno. As yet, of course, I knew nothing of their numbers or feelings, but my expectations were far from being roseate.
"But man," I cried, turning to Burnett, "would you massacre helpless multitudes? You who prayed of tyranny, would you also play the role of tyrants?"
Before the gathering horror, all my wonder at the Attila had vanished. I felt only the helpless, abject dismay with which one confronts an appalling but inevitable calamity. At that moment, some disaster to the Aranuf would have been welcome. The masterful vice of the fanatics maddened me. Rebel, however, as I might, I was of no account. The snake that snapped at the file had more in his favor.
"We don't argue here," said Burnett. "We act. If you want arguments, you must wait till you see the captain. Disputes with us are useless."
So even he was becoming surly. It was natural enough, however, as a moment's reflection showed. The alligator on land is ordinarily mild enough. In his element, he is invariably a terrible monster. The suspect anarchist of Stepney was courteous and argumentative, but the free and independent anarchist of the Attila dogmatic and brutal. It was obviously best policy to humor him, for he alone perhaps might stand by me at a pinch. I endeavored to throw oil on the troubled waters.
"He used not to mind criticism," I urged.
"Oh, no, but those days are past. Don't take what I say unkindly, for we all mean you well. The captain will always talk, but we here are tired of it. We only exist now to act, when the word is passed. So you will consult our convenience and your own much more effectually if you drop all such homilies in for the future."
"Yes," put in Thomas. "I had enough of it in London. 15 years of revolutionary socialist talking and nothing ever done. But wait a few weeks, and I warrant it will be said that we here have atoned wonderfully well for arrears. Come, a glass to our captain, the destined destroyer of civilization."
The gallant three, acting on this hint, left me to digest their advice and retired within. How long I remained thinking, I know not. Someone brought me a chair, but I was too distracted to thank him. For fully an hour, I must have looked down on those twinkling lights with a terror beyond the power of words to express. All was as Burnett had said. The dream of Hartman was realized. The exile, an outcast, lately sheltered from the law in the shadow of continental cities, now enjoyed powers such as 100 czars could not hope for. The desperados with him, hated by and hating society, were probably one and all devoured by lust of blood and revenge. The three I knew were all proscribed men, loathing not only the landlord and capitalist, but the workers, who would most of them have voiced over their capture. They attacked not only the abuses and defects, but the very foundations of society. Their long-cherished thought had been to shatter the trophies of centuries, and the long-contemplated opportunity had come at last. One resource remained. What they meant to do with me was uncertain, but my relations with Burnett and the friendship of Hartman's mother were sufficient to avert any apprehension of violence. My endeavor then henceforth must be to work on the mind of Hartman to divert this engine of mischief into as fair a course as possible, to achieve by its aid a durable and relatively bloodless social revolution, and to reap by an authority so secure from overthrow a harvest of beneficial results. Buoyed up by these brighter thoughts, I now began to find time for a more immediate interest. What of this wonderful vessel, or Aranuf, itself? What was it built of? How was it propelled, supported, steered, manned, constructed? Rising from my chair, I felt my way along the railing forward, but found the way barred by some door or partition. As I made my way back, I met Burnett, who emerged from the low door already mentioned.
"What, exploring already?" he said. "It's no good at this hour. You'll have doubtless discovered. Come inside and I'll see you are made cozy for the night. You must want to sleep, surely."
I followed him in without a word. Passing into the chamber, he pressed a spring in the wall, and a concealed door flew back, revealing a dark recess. He struck a light, and there became visible a comfortable berth with the usual appurtenances of a homely cabin, such as one would occupy in the second-class saloon of an ordinary ocean-going steamer.
"By the way," I said, "you've not told me what happened in the park. I'm dying to know."
"It's easily told. When you fell, the two detectives were up in a moment. I turned around, meaning to shoot, but before I emptied a barrel, crack, 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 came a series of reports from aloft, and both men were settled, one spinning right across you. See, your coat is covered with blood." The explanation is that 30 feet up, between the alleys of the trees, floated the Attila, and Hartman and Schwartz were indulging in a little sport. I very soon climbed up the ladder, which was swinging close by the tree we were to have come to, and you were shortly afterwards hauled up in a carefully tied sheet.
"Why did we take you on board? I'm surprised at your asking. We could not stop, and the idea of leaving you stunned and in the compromising company of dead men was not arguable. Would you have relished the idea of a trial as murderer and anarchist?" You meant well, you see, by me, and the captain was strong in your favor. Some of the men know of you, and no one has had a bad word to say, save that your theories were rather utopian. But you may change. For a while I was silent. I thought of my utopian project. Then I said, so far as my theories go, I will confine myself now to one remark. An airship may be used as well as abused. Burnett laughed. That's better. Don't forget, however, to define your view of us to the captain. Hello, I must be off on watch. An electric bell tinkled sharply in the outer chamber. Good night.
Good night.
Just before turning in, I looked closely at the basin of my washhand stand. It was of the same silvery-gray color which I had noted on the walls of the cabin, and which indeed seemed ubiquitous. A sudden thought struck me. I emptied out the water and lifted it up. Its weight seemed so absurdly small that I could hardly believe my senses. But one thing was clear. The mystery of the thin, silvery-gray plate was explained. It was out of such materials that the body of the Attila was fashioned. The riddle of Schwartz, previously half-brushed aside, was at last solved completely. As I was dropping off to sleep, a novel reflection assailed me. Why would Lena think of my absence tomorrow? Of this terrible night in the park, she would not, of course, dream still. But sleep speedily quenched my thinking. Chapter 6. On the Deck of the Attila. It was late the next morning when a thought and feeling came back to me, the blurred imagery of my dreams mingling strangely with the memories of the preceding night. Despite a slight headache and a suspicion or two of giddiness, I felt as well as could be expected, and lying back snugly on my pillow began to meditate, rising. For once my resolution was quick in the making. My uncle used to say that all things considered, life was not worth the trouble of dressing, but on this particular morning it most certainly was. The apprehensions of the past night had given way to a hopeful spirit, while the interest of exploring this Aranef thrilled me through and through. I was about to spring out of the berth in readiness for the labors of the toilet when Burnett looked in through the door. All right, glad to hear. Where are we? Over the North Sea. Take my advice and get up sharp. The captain has asked to see you. You'll find me knocking about somewhere around here when you're ready. Thoroughly alive to the situation, I was not long in getting into my clothes. But my disgust was great on finding sundry half-dried splashes of blood on my coat, a souvenir of my luckless pursuer. In the excitement and darkness, I had overlooked these hideous traces, which now seemed to threaten me with the brand of Cain. Throwing aside the polluted garment, I stepped into the outer chamber, my pleasure quite overcast for the moment. Burnett was there, and a hearty breakfast was awaiting me, to which I promised to do summary and sweeping justice. The room, but feebly apparent for the foregoing night, was now flooded with the sunlight, but the height at which we floated rendered the air most chilly and penetrating. The silvery-gray color of the walls, floor, chairs, benches, tables, and even the dishes and mugs wrought an impressive effect, curiously set off by the red cap worn by Burnett. Through the open doorway gleamed the same silvery-gray livery of the flooring and bulwark of the passage, already mentioned, and framed, as it were, in silver, glowed a truly magnificent cloud picture. The skyscape, however, was unstable. Mass after mass of mist, shaped into turrets, battlements, and mountains, rolled by in picturesque splendor, bearing artistic testimony to the speed at which we were moving. "Beautiful, isn't it?" said Burnett. "Here, eat your breakfast, and then I'll show you round our cloud empire. Perhaps you had best see the captain as soon as possible." I said I thought that would be the best. "Where's your coat, man?" "Oh, I remember. Wait, and I'll fetch you one of mine." In a short time, the missing garment was made good, and I was falling to with avidity. "How do you manage your meals and service here? Have you cooks or servants?" "Of course not. We are anarchists, and everything depends on private initiative. Every man is as good as another, and every man is a volunteer. Later on, you'll be expected to bestir yourself also." "But how do you avoid chaos?" "There is no chaos to avoid. Outside the engine room and conning tower, there is little a man cannot quickly learn to do at need. We are very simple in our wants, that is the part of our creed, and consequently have a deal of leisure. The watches are the worst part, for the captain is very particular."
Wait a minute. What authority has he?"
"The authority of the soul of this enterprise, and its best man. We would voluntarily support him in a crisis. 5 days ago, a couple of Italians turned rusty. He shot both where they stood, and the men in their hearts approved of it. But he is an iron man. Wait till you see him."
"Is anyone on the Attila free to go where he likes?"
"Yes, except into the captain's quarters. To pass there, a permit is required to all except myself, Schwartz, and Thomas. The engine room watchers pass through every 3 hours, and a passage runs from it to the conning tower and magazine below. You may guess what the latter contains."
"How many men are aboard?"
25, excluding ourselves. 8 are Germans, 6 Englishmen, 4 French, 2 Russians, and an Italian. And the others Swiss. Some of those whom Hartmann employed at Bern."
"Bern? Was that where the Attila was built?"
"That's it. Hartmann Schwartz and a Swiss workman put her together. He'd made money there, as you know, and this was his grand investment. It was kept beautifully dark in the wooded grounds of his villa. We're going there now, so you will see the place for yourself. But does anyone know of the Attila? No outsider, probably, who would be believed if he said anything. We have our friends down below, of course, never you fear, but they are mum. The hour is not yet struck, but the preparations for the festival are being merrily carried out. The Attila is a secret for the present. To avoid being seen, we take every precaution possible and never approach the ground except at night. In the daytime, well, there are clouds, and if none, we simply mount higher, and then our color is enough to conceal us. But what if you meet a balloon? Oh, there's very little chance of that. And if there was, the balloonist might find cause to regret the meeting. But come, I'll take you round to the captain. He's a better spokesman than I. Right you are. We stepped out onto the passage, and rushing to the bulwark, if I may so call it, I gazed rapturously into the abyss below. It was indeed a glorious sight. The clouds hung around and below us, and here and there through their rents flashed the blue of a waste of rolling waters. Ever and anon these gaps would be speckled with rushing seabirds whose cries mellowed by the distance broke on the ear like music. Above in the clear blue sky shone the sun at the keystone of his low winter arch, lighting up the cloud masses with a splendor words cannot describe. Far ahead, through a break on my right, a faint, thin streak of distant land seemed visible. "Hello!" I cried. "Look! There! Land!" Burnett shaded his eyes. I can see nothing. "Ah, yes! By Jove! Who's on watch? We ought to be rising!" As he spoke, a sudden pitch of the aeronef nearly upset us. The speed rapidly increased, and the wind became positively cutting. "We're rising fast," said Burnett. "See, we're leaving the cloud bank far below us." But a new marvel had just caught my eye, and clinging to the handrail, I gazed upwards in astonishment. The wall of the chamber behind us was continuous with the main mass of the aeronef, which, looking from where we stood, exhibited the graceful lines of the ship's hull. Round this hull, and presumably halfway up it, ran the railed passage where we were standing, communicating here and there with doorways let into the gray side. Some 30 feet above us, the side curved upwards and inwards so as to terminate in a flat railed deck on which a few moving heads were just visible. But above this, again, rose a forest of thin gray poles running up to a vast oblong aeroplane, which stretched some way beyond the hull. All these props were carefully stayed together, and those towards the bow were somewhat higher than those in the stern, provision being made thus for the inclination of the aeroplane consistently with due maintenance of the hull's equilibrium below. In the latter part of the 19th century, much progress had been made in experiments with aeroplanes, those of Maxim being particularly suggestive and interesting. I was therefore at no loss to probe the significance of this portion of the mechanism. "The captain wishes to see you," said Burnett, who was talking to a solemn-looking fellow by the doorway. "Come along." He stepped briskly along the passage, and when we had gone some 15 yards, turned up one of the alleys. Entering behind him, I came to a small court surrounded with rooms and cabins, leaving which we ascended a spiral staircase to the upper deck. Glancing hastily around, I saw 5 or 6 men pacing about chatting, while from other courts below came the sounds of singing and laughter. This deck, which capped the entire hull, was no less than 80 yards in length, with an extreme breadth of at least 35. Broad at the stern, it narrowed off to a sharp point at the bow. The props attached to the aeroplane were set in 6 rows, curving close together, amidships where they stood a small circular citadel, evidently the stronghold of the captain. Here were mounted 3 or 4 cannon of the quick-firing sort, fashioned out of the same gray substance as the Attila, but the utility of which in a vessel carrying dynamite was not immediately obvious. The citadel itself bore no outward signs of comfort. It had 4 square windows and a plain hull of an entrance let into bare shining walls. An exterior wall 6 feet high, surrounded with spikes, and having here and there a recess sheltering a machine gun, enclosed it. A fitter abode for the man I could not conceive. Sullen, isolated, and menacing, it inspired me with a vague premonitory dread. Burnett strode up to the entrance and pressed a knob. I heard the ting of an electric bell, and a man, Thomas if I remember right, came out and said the captain would see me alone. Mastering some natural excitement, I bowed and followed him in. We passed through the inner portal and found ourselves in a narrow hall, flights of steps from which led down into the inmost vitals of the Attila. On our right was the door half open. My escort motioned me to enter, and pulling the door to, left me to face with Hartmann.